Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, or whatever time you are listening to our show. Thank you so much for joining us. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am Rob Watson. Tonight's episode is one I'm so excited about. We have on with us, waiting on deck, Kathy Reyna. Kathy is certainly a behind-the-scenes person to many, many years of the LGBTQ movement. And she has been giving us the narrative, the talking points, the thoughts, the ideas, the point, the moral, everything about everything that happens to us and has happened to us has probably come through her typewriter and her thought process as one of the great communicators of our movement. She has worked for GLAAD and through that organization, help frame narratives from the Matthew Shepard slaying to marriage equality to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and many of the dramas and pitfalls and triumphs in between. Most recently, she worked on the landmark recognition of World Pride just this year, the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. And so she has seen, heard, and talked about a great deal of our pride history. So we have dubbed her as the queen of talking about pride, and we will be talking to her shortly and getting all of her thoughts. Before I bring Kathy on, though, I do want to welcome Brody Levesque to the show. And with that, Brody, good evening.
Good evening, Rob, and good evening to our listeners. And it's been a week.
So, Brody,
a long one.
It has been
yeah.
a week. So I have some news about our show and the way people are listening to it. For people who didn't know, and maybe some of our listeners already knew this, but you can easily listen to us through your podcast button and application on your smartphone. So if you go into that application and do a search on Rated LGBT Radio, we pop up. You hit subscribe. All of our past shows are there, and you can listen to them at any time, any place, anywhere on your happy little smartphone. And I'm happy to report that when you do that, you will see that we are rated with a glorious 5 stars. So just
wow.
another way people can find us. Yep.
Well, that's
good work.
That's very cool. Yeah, and I'm glad we're 5 stars. No, seriously, that's actually very, very cool, especially, you know, the amount of work that we put into bringing some really, really interesting guests and topics to the show, and we have for the last 2 or 3 years. So that's actually really nice to hear that. So, yeah, please. Download the app and listen to us. You won't regret it. And
actually, you know,
so,
on most phones, it's automatically mm-hmm. on the phone. So this is one of those apps you probably don't have to even download. You just have to look through your buttons and find the one that says podcast.
Okay. All right. Well, I was going to give you some grief for referencing Kathy and typewriters. Of course, my, you know, technological proudness isn't that much better, so I guess I wasn't going to go there. Anyway,
do we have to explain to our millennial audience what typewriters were? Is that your point?
I you know what? I'm not even going to touch that one. Speaking of things that I would really not like to touch, we'll start with the Mafia Don sitting behind the Resolute desk in the Oval. Who has touched off some pretty nasty controversy this week. almost in an illustrative way, a Virginia church, a Baptist Virginia church in Appomattox, Virginia, put up a sign this week that says, America, love it or leave it, which my good friend Brandon Wolf, who's a friend of our show's, and you've had Brandon on many times before, also put up a black and white historic photograph that was taken many years ago near Smithfield, Virginia. And it says on the billboard, this is Klan country, love it or leave it. Help fight communism and integration, KKK. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because the president of the United States decided that he wanted to attack four representatives of the United States House. Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. And he told them that they should go back to their home countries, which prompted a rather large backlash. I guess I should mention that the four ladies are of color and of different ethnicities. And yeah, it just kind of went in the toilet from there. He doubled down on it. He stepped up his attacks. On Tuesday, he told the congressmen that they should go wherever they want, but they should love our country, they shouldn't hate our country, and if they didn't, well, then they can leave. And then yesterday, he was in North Carolina for a political rally, and he brought up one of the congresswomen, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, who happens to be from Somali, but is a naturalized United States citizen. And as he started to mention her, the crowd behind him broke into chants of send her home, send her home, send her home. Most of the discussions today have been centering around that. The other part of it was that Trump attempted to walk it back, but at the end of the day, it wasn't sincere. And I think it really reeked of insincerity. But what really shocked me was that in the rush of conservatives to say something to the president about that, and this is on the heels of a House vote last night of a resolution condemning his initial remarks, most of what I saw today coming out of conservatives, if they weren't defending Trump outright by saying, well, it wasn't racist, it was the constant back and forth of, well, you know, the leftist this and the leftist that and the socialist democratic this. And I sat there and I watched this unfold on Twitter. My fellow editors and I during our editorial conference today at about noontime, and disclosure, I worked for a foreign wire service. So we were discussing the American situation on the ground. And it was just kind of one of these situations where, yeah, America's broke really bad. And I'm not sure you can fix this nonsense. Humpty Dumpty, ladies and gentlemen, fell off the bloody wall, and there's no gluing this sucker back together again. I can honestly tell you in the four decades that I've been a political reporter and an editor, I don't think I have ever, ever seen anything like this. And it goes places. I got asked by a friend tonight that was there, you know, any depth to the depravity or the way that he would go. And I it's like, there's no bar with him. He doesn't care. His supporters don't care. This is it. You know, this is him. And he's, you know, he's ripped the scab, the band-aid, whatever you want to call it, off of a wound that, quite frankly, I don't think probably ever healed anyway. And, you know, going back to the American Civil War, probably even before. And, yeah, he's tweaking it and fine-tuning it. And, you know, he's just raising hate and bigotry to a whole new level. And this is just, I don't know, Rob. It's a place I don't think the Americans have ever seen a presidency go.
Well, yeah, I would agree with that. The thing that I have a little bit of different take on this whole thing, and not to undermine the complete travesty in terms of how he's expressed himself, what he's done, and where he's gone with it. But he has gone here before. He has no stop signs in his mind in terms of who he'll attack and how far he'll go. There is some strategy to this, and I think a very specific strategy that I'm not sure he's being given credit for. And the reason I'm pointing it out this way isn't to give him credit as much as to look at the strategy so that we on the other side can strategically answer it in a way that it won't work. And that is, he pulled this around the midterms as well. And in the midterms, he focused on Maxine Waters and tried to portray her as the sole voice of the Democratic Party. Now, for me personally, I wouldn't even mind if that were the case, but it was just interesting to me because it's a dog whistle. And yes, it has complete racist under and overtones to its whistle. But beyond that, it also is taking people who basically have the freedom to speak without any kind of balance in terms of their progressive thoughts. These four congresswomen are mavericks. They're coming into Congress. They have new ideas. Some of them are completely impractical. The heart is behind all of them. They're a little bit bull in the China cabinet. For those of us who agree with the concepts that they're talking about, it's like, great, fresh blood, fresh information, fresh ideas. Let's think this out. Let's work this out. Let's find ways to make things happen and have this effect. To people on the other side, this is terrifying. It's like, and I'm not talking about their ethnicity. I'm talking about the progressive ideas, and it is moving things too far too fast for a lot of people. That's why Joe Biden is really the front runner for the Democratic Party, because he is much more centrist. He would embrace these ideas, but at the same time provide balance and practicality in terms of how to get the job done. Trump does not want to run against that person. He does not want to run against somebody who methodically will bring progress and sensibility, or to someone who will speak to the middle class. He doesn't want that. So what Trump has done with this big circus this week is done one thing very specifically. He is trying to make these four new congresswomen the voice of the Democratic Party. It doesn't matter that none of them are running for president. That is what he has cast. And I had the unfortunate opportunity to listen to about an hour of Fox News over the radio, and one of their commentators was actually making this exact point, sort of in an objective standpoint. The other ones were kind of picking up the ball and running with it, with how these four congresswomen were exactly the Democratic Party today. This is who he was going to be running against in 2020, and really underscoring the intent of this strategy. It was ironic in their conversation, because while they were talking about it and they were talking about the vote that happened in front of the House of Representatives, they mentioned the fact that there were four Republican congressmen who voted along with the Democrats to censure Trump in terms of his racist commentary. And they, in their dialogue about this, made a point to say that these four Republicans were inconsequential. They were only four of them. What did that mean? While they heralded these four congresswomen who they want to elevate to be the boogeymen that they want to go after. So that, to me, is what is happening with Trump and makes all of this believable, even though it is still outrageous. But the other piece of this is the Epstein scandal, which there is this sideline implication of Trump on this, and I swear to God, part of the MO of this is a two-edged sword, that not only does he get to find who he wants to run against, but he's also distracting the media this week from digging in deeper to his own potential involvement in what could be at least as bad a scandal as he's ever seen, if not the worst. So that's my take on what's been going on this week.
Okay. All right. Well, let us bring on our guest. Now, in full disclosure and transparency, which is something those of us in the media don't often get credited for, hardy, har, har, all kidding aside, I've had the unique, singular honor of knowing Kathy over the last two decades. We were a lot younger when we met. I was part of the tsunami of press that descended on Laramie, Wyoming, in the aftermath of the murder of Matthew Shepard and the trial. Kathy was amazing at what she did and the way she handled the press. And I think even more importantly, under some extremely trying circumstances, not just only for the Shepherd family, Judy and Dennis and Logan, but for Matt's friends. A shout out here to a mutual friend of ours, Jim Osborne, in Laramie, Wyoming, big gay Jim. But the most interesting part about it is that no matter what happened, I never once saw Kathy lose the plot. She's absolutely fearless. She maintains her cool. You know, if ever there was to be a candidate that I would recommend for a progressive presidential press secretary, she would get my vote hands down. And with that, I'll throw it to you.
Okay. Well, with that, and we have dubbed her the queen of communication, I'm going to bring on and welcome Kathy Renna. And Kathy, welcome to the show. And I guess Brody has framed the first question. Should one of the Democratic nominees make it to the White House, maybe Mayor Pete, for example, and you get donned as the White House press secretary, would you take the job?
Well, you know, I lived in Washington for 10 years and somehow managed to not get involved in politics per se. So I don't know. Hey, never say never. That would be a really interesting thing. And given where we're, what we're living with now, it's, yeah, I'd be happy to be CJ to anybody's, well, everybody watched The West Wing, right? So no, I actually stood behind that podium. I stood behind that podium once, it was while we were hanging out waiting to go into the White House, and it was right after Trump was elected, which was a little ironic. But, you know, that's not necessarily, as Brody knows well, that's not my wheelhouse. I'm in the community. I'm in the trenches, and I like that. And that's the way I've kept it, actually, for, I'm happy to say, almost 30 years. I don't mind dating myself. I don't think I ever really used a typewriter. But, yeah, it's been about 30 years, so.
well, that's okay. At least we don't have to explain to you what one is. So that
my daughter. My daughter is a teenager, and at one point I said, "You sound like a broken record," and she said, "What's a record?" And I was like, "Oh, it's all over. That's just the end of that." I have no answer.
My favorite is the rotary phone. That there's a video of millennials looking at a rotary phone trying to figure out how it works.
How to use it.
They keep punching it. So Kathy, how did you get started with this communication career with the movement? What was your first entree into being the communication thought person and creating a narrative?
You know, that's a funny story. So I actually moved to Washington, D.C. right after college to go to graduate school. I had every intention of fulfilling my childhood dream of becoming a doctor. obviously that didn't work out. So I decided to get involved in something in the community. And I'll be perfectly frank, you know, at the time for, you know, in terms of socializing, it was really, you know, there were bars, you know. And my girlfriend at the time and I decided, well, you know, let's go to something. And we went to a panel discussion, and I still have the flyer for it. It was like 1989, I think, or so. And it was entitled Lesbian Invisibility in the Media, because at the time, lesbians were pretty darn invisible. And on the panel was a woman who helped start the GLAAD chapter in Washington, D.C. Her name was Ann Warner. She was fantastic. And I was just super intrigued. I've always been a media and pop culture kind of person. And so I started volunteering at GLAAD. And, you know, you may talk about typewriters. We had computers by then. But we, you know, literally cutting articles out of the Washington Post and, you know, the Washington Times and, you know, like, really doing the very unsexy work of literally monitoring the media in a very challenging way. Obviously, with the internet now, it's a lot easier. There was no Google News alerts then. And that's how I got started. I volunteered at the GLAAD chapter. I ended up chairing the Media Monitoring Committee. I was then the co-chair of the chapter. And then, you know, several years into that, by the mid-90s, GLAAD grew. And the chapters all merged, and we became a national organization, and I was put on the staff. And so, you know, I would joke increasingly, you know, as I went through the 90s with my parents, who were, you know, I'd been out since I was a kid, and, you know, then I got involved in things. And then all of a sudden, my dad was like, wait, you're getting paid to be gay? You know, very funny about it. But essentially, yes. And so it really has turned into this. You know, I have to pinch myself all the time, and as I was, and I'm sure we'll talk about all the things that happened this past June with World Pride and Stonewall 50, and, you know, to be in the middle of these things and to be able to experience them and meet the people and play a role in sort of shaping how the public sees us, but also how history gets reported, right? Because they always say journalism and news is sort of the first rough draft of history. You know, that's been an incredible journey for me. And that's what I feel like I've, you know, had the chance to grow into. I mean, after being at GLAAD for about 14 years, I left. I worked at a firm for a little bit. And then I just went out on my own. And then, and really since 2003 or so, 2004, I've had, I've been doing LGBT media consulting with all kinds of different organizations, some of which you talked about when you did the intro. And, it's really been extraordinary. It really, you know, I've had a chance to, like Brody said, be behind the scenes and also, you know, sometimes in front of the camera, to be in the position of helping people better understand who we are as a community. And it feels like an awesome responsibility, and I take it extremely seriously. And it's also, it's very fulfilling and really awesome, sometimes challenging, but, you know,
yeah, it's vitally important. I mean, I don't know that people today, honestly, can understand how important your work especially was back in the day, because they're used to, I mean, we open up, you know, the internet, and we see NBC, CBS, CNN, and they put out stories that just a few years ago you couldn't read in mainstream media. You'd have to read specifically the LGBTQ press to see the points of view and just the clarity of reporting about it. Because I remember like 15 years ago, I was doing a tour of newspapers, and they felt they had to balance their reporting on gay issues with the religious right. I mean, in other words, they couldn't publish something that was just about gay people.
Yeah.
They had to bring in this other you know, critical voice about why gay people shouldn't even exist in their reporting.
Exactly.
And to them, that was what was balanced reporting. So your job, you know, in the early days to go through and advocate and correct, you know, misrepresentation of us in the media was a huge, huge, huge part of the battle. And I don't want anybody to ever look or undermine or underestimate what you've done. because mm-hmm. that has,
yeah,
has
that
been
was the
huge.
Majority. Yeah, I mean, that was the majority of the battle for the really the first really up until the late 90s. I mean, we started to see some changes in the, you know, sort of early 2000s, but it has not been that long that, you know, and I from experience know this, you know, to have those kinds of conversations, like you were just saying with journalists where, you know, they want to talk to the other side. And I countless times have had that conversation of the other side of what? Either I exist and I should be treated equally with respect or not. What's the other side of that? And the interesting thing is that we made so much progress, and in the last several years, unfortunately, the pendulum has swung the other way, particularly around trans issues where, you know, we were just starting to really see, you know, more nuance and increases in visibility of the trans community and non-binary communities. And, you know, it's really, to me, probably the biggest challenge we face in media today is getting the media to understand that, you know, they just don't need to run off and talk to the folks on the family or the Family Research Council or, you know, some of the TERFs or anti-trans folks that are out there to get, quote-unquote, the other side. But, you know,
right.
That's what our community is about. We're an incredibly diverse community. We're constantly pushing the envelope and you know, making people think about issues around gender and sexuality in a different way.
So, Kathy, Go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to follow up with what Kathy and you were just talking about, if I may. As a member of the mainstream media, one of the things that I think was critically important, at least in the way we were looking at things and covering, I think an event, if you will, and this will be kind of a parallel to what we're going to talk about here in a little while about Stonewall 50, but I think one of the things that made a difference for us in the media, and Kathy, I think you probably agree with me, was the Matthew Shepard case. Because
mm-hmm.
for the first time,
yeah.
You know, the narrative changed. And I can tell you that one of the things that I think was probably the most important thing about Matthew's case was not only just the force of the personality of both Dennis and Judy, of course, but the narrative of Matthew as the kid next door, as grandma's kid. Judy once told me that she felt that the reason that things really fired up the way they did was because suddenly all these American grandmothers kind of latched onto that and was like, wait, that
mm-hmm.
could be my grandkid. And I think that that's kind of one of the things that propelled everything in motion, at least for those of us in the mainstream press. And as Rob pointed out, you know, for a very long time, you know, my profession didn't cover LGBTQ issues unless it was in a hugely negative way, such as the AIDS pandemic. And I'm not very proud of some of the coverage we did during that time period. As a matter of fact, it was pretty bad. But I think that, you know, we didn't pay attention to that, and it was kind of a negative thing. And as you both said, even into the middle of the 2000s, we were still, and I was fighting this issue too with my bosses about, you know, we don't need to have this coverage balanced, okay, by these folks at Family Research Council or Focus on the Family or the American Family Association, because it's going to be completely non-secular, very much religious-oriented, and it's not factual. And, of course, that was a long-going battle with that. Kathy, when you're looking at it, you went into the private sector away from the nonprofit NGO world. What was the most important thing to you? And this is like right after the Shepard case had kind of broken out, and Ellen and everybody else, and just there was like a change. It was a seismic change. What was the most important thing that you felt that you were doing at that time period in contribution to making people more aware and getting the messaging out there? And I'm also keeping in mind that you were starting out in 2003, 2004, right about the time that the marriage issue became a campaign
mm-hmm.
issue with the Bush re-election. Do you mind kind of going back there and saying what it was that kind of you felt were the most important items for you in the private sector?
Sure, sure. No, not at all. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, even though I worked at a firm for a few years, and I think what I realized, and it was a progressive firm, it was a terrific place, but it was still out of the reach, resource-wise, cost-wise, to almost all of the LGBT nonprofits. I mean, communications work, the kind of work I do, is not inexpensive. Let's put it that way. So that was part of the reason I left. I mean, the other part was because I wanted to see my daughter grow up. She was about 6 months old when I started my firm. But I did it because I wanted to provide high-level, sophisticated communications, consulting, strategy, crisis communications, media training, all the things of public relations, all the things we talk about, to nonprofit LGBTQ organizations because it wasn't accessible in any other way. I'm not doing anything very differently than what I did when I worked at GLAAD. What I get to do, though, is I get to do it independently. I get to decide who I work with, and I get to be a resource to organizations that in other situations would never be able to afford the kind of level of media work that I do. And I'm not saying that to be like egotistical. I'm saying it because it's a matter of fact. Unless you get a big firm and, you know, even if they say they'll do a pro bono, I mean, as much as they're well-intentioned, you're not going to be a priority the way a client is. And so what I've done essentially is, as an individual consultant with, you know, at times a small staff, interns, et cetera, been able to provide to small or medium and large organizations, as, you know, like New York City Pride and GLSEN and the Task Force and other large organizations I work with as well, the kind of additional communications infrastructure and resources that can really help them get their stories out there in an environment where it's still very difficult. I mean, it's not easy to get out there in the media, even though we have all these new platforms and all these new ways of doing it. It's still very competitive. And we still have that component of, you know, I don't work with organizations that just want their name in the paper or online or on TV. They have issues they care about. They have people that they work with and for. And it's about telling those stories. And so that's how I see what I do. So it's kind of weird. I mean, yes, of course, I have my own firm, and it's kind of in the public sector that way. But I only work really almost exclusively, I would say 99% of my clients are nonprofit organizations, and they're almost all LGBTQ organizations, which I actually didn't think would be the case. I thought I would have to diversify some just to, you know, keep myself afloat. But as it has turned out, which I'm thrilled about, I've been able to maintain this working with almost all LGBTQ organizations. And that's really been, you know, to me, one of the most satisfying things that I've been able to accomplish, I think, in the last, you know, 10, 15 years that I've been doing this.
Yeah. Kathy, I want to put you on the spot on something with a specific form of communication and your vast insight from having been on board, you know, early on and everything you've seen and you've been through. One thing in the corporate world that gets talked about in terms of a communication vehicle is what is known as, quote unquote, the elevator pitch. In other words, when you have something that you're trying to get across in a strategic way, you walk into the elevator and there standing next to you is the CEO of the company. He or she pushes the button and you have from the first floor to the 10th floor to tell the story. If you were caught in the elevator with the CEO who knew nothing about the LGBTQ movement that you've experienced, what would that elevator pitch from the first floor to the 10th floor sound like?
From me? Is that what you're talking about?
From you.
That's your question?
And what
how would
seen?
I explain it?
Yeah.
I mean, the way I talk about the community, I'm very, very, very specific. I mean, I basically say you really need to look at the LGBTQ community as a microcosm of the larger culture. I mean, that's our diversity, while it can be a challenge, is our greatest strength. And the thing that brings LGBTQ people together has nothing to do with our age, our race, our ethnicity, where we come from, our economic status, any of those things. And so when you're looking at our community, you have to understand that you're looking at a microcosm of our entire culture. And when I explain it that way to people, they go, oh, I never thought about it that way, which will be the title of my memoir when I write it eventually, because that's my goal when I'm talking to somebody, whether it's a journalist or a client or whoever, is to get them to think, I never thought about it that way. Because it takes out of the realm of queer people being abstract. It kind of sets them on a journey to think about us differently. And to me, that is the way to educate people and to have them open up their minds to better understand who we are.
Well, you actually answered one of my next questions. Is there's got to be a book coming out of you. You cannot do what you've done and not write a book, right?
I need some time. I've had several people talk to me about this. I either need a lot of time or ghostwrite. But I would love to do that. And what I'd love to do is not just have it be like, I mean, I jokingly said a memoir. I would love to write something that, from my practical experience, could help others. Because that's one of the things I really try and do. And I do a little differently, I think, than a lot of folks in the sort of PR profession. I mean, my goal when I'm working with an organization is to kind of make myself obsolete. Like, I love to help organizations build their skills, build their infrastructure, build their media lists, you know, mentor staff so that they can become the communications director. And then I can go work on something else with someone else, you know, and move on to another frontier or another issue or whatever. I think that's really, really important and something that we don't actually see or do enough of in our community. And I'm, you know, if I'm anything, as Brody knows, if I'm anything, I'm blunt. And if you ask me what I think, I will tell you. So when you're asking about elevator pitch and sound bites and, like, you know, clients are often a little surprised. They don't get the sort of standard line of you need to have a sound bite. And I'm more of a, you need to speak from your heart. You need to tell your story. You need to be honest. You need to be accessible. You need to understand your audience. You know, I keep things very real in the work that I do. And I think it shows. It shows in the organizations that I work with. I think it showed, you know, and I know we're going to talk about Stonewall 50 and World Pride. I think it really shows with that and all the, you know, often complex issues that we deal with within our community. Because it always goes back to what I said, you know, in my little elevator pitch, you know, we're a super diverse community. We have, you know, some real challenges when it comes to trying to find common ground around certain issues and, you know, the issues that intersect for us. I mean, you know, I may happen to be a lesbian, but I'm also a lot of other things. So I care about other issues as well. So I know that for our community, the intersectionality and the idea that we have multiple parts of our identity that we want to and do care about and want to address is increasingly important, and it's increasingly something that we are exploring and talking about in the media, which can often be a little bit challenging, but to me is absolutely vital and the only honest and genuine way to do this work.
Sure. And well, one thing we need to... and I'm sure, Brody is never blunt back in return.
Oh, no, not at all. Kathy knows me only too well. Let me ask something real quick here, because and this is kind of germane to what just took place. 50 years ago in a mafia-run bottle bar, something got started. And it set things in motion. And here we are 50 years out from it in an environment that I think a lot of the veterans, or at least the ones that I've talked to, weren't sure that they would even recognize as someone had said. Mm. And mm-hmm. I think that the most important part of this goes back to the heart of what you do. And I say that as a journalist as well, and that's messaging. Especially with some of the ways that, you know, there were so many stories and so many things that were revolving around how important this particular season of Pride was. And many mm-hmm. of the participants that you were dealing with, I also, in full transparency, know personally, like Mark Siegel, for example. But give Rob and I kind of a feel for stepping back and looking at what just took place, and give us just kind of a brief analysis of, you know, the moment. Because I really, the impression I got in all the conversations that I had with folks and the media coverage that there was that there was a certain amount of folks going, wow, really?
I'm sorry, I missed that last part. What did you say?
I said that there was a certain amount of wow, really. It's like they were sitting there.
Yeah.
Look, yeah. Okay. So I'll let you go from there, Cap.
I can really help you with the wow, really. I actually got a preliminary media report from the monitoring service that I use, and I told them that the number would start with a B, not an M, but there were almost 17 billion media impressions related to World Pride and Stonewall 50 internationally, which is really like, I mean, short of a presidential election or the Olympics, the service that I use they were thrilled, and they said this is one of the biggest reports like we've ever done in our history. I mean, they were absolutely astounded, and I kind of had a feeling I knew it was going to be epic. I knew it was going to be historic. And when we started working on this last year, I mean, I've worked with New York City Pride in the past, and I've worked with BC Capital Pride Alliance for many years. There were two things we talked about when we decided, you know, they decided to bring me on to help with this convergence, very intentional, planned convergence of World Pride for the first time in the United States and Stonewall 50 and the commemoration of, you know, 50 years since the Stonewall Rebellion, which is seen as really, you know, sort of the mark of the modern LGBT movement. We all know there was work being done prior to that, but the attention that the Stonewall Rebellion got was definitely sort of historical in the way that it sparked the larger community. And so there were two things we talked about. One was this was a true opportunity to have a global platform to talk about not just the past 50 years, but the next 50 years. What still needs to be done? Because especially in the last few years here in the U.S., and we know in many countries around the world, not only is it difficult to be queer, it's a death sentence. It's, you know, we still live in a world where there is just so much homophobia and transphobia. And this was going to be a chance to have a global platform to talk about what still needs to be done. That was absolutely priority number one. The other one, which in many ways equally as important, was to get the history right, to spend the time and do all the work that we needed to do to make sure that the media, when looking at this, you know, sort of seminal event in our community's history, but also our larger history, which even those of us within the community don't always know about or have the accurate information about, was to make sure that we got, as they used to say in Philly, you know, get your history straight and your nightlife gay. That was like your tourism slogan for a while. Great. Those were my two priorities. I mean, when New York City Pride brought me on, it wasn't, you know, for me to help. You know, they don't really need help with that. I mean, we did events on a scale that have never been done by an LGBT organization for anything ever. I mean, it was obviously the largest pride in history. I mean, the opening ceremony for World Pride was the largest LGBT fundraising benefit concert ever. It benefited SAGE, the Ali Frenay Center, and Immigration Equality. The march was the largest ever. We had nearly 200,000 people in the march on Sunday, on June 30th. And we had 5 million people. It was the largest event in New York of any kind in a single day. Not just LGBT, not just Pride, of any kind in New York City. It's really extraordinary. And so, you know, taking on that kind of responsibility, you have to understand that there were 3 communications people at Pride, me, the media director, and the social media and marketing person. Basically all my other clients were on hiatus for several months, except for Capital Pride. We had over 1,000 media outlets that were credentialed for various events, you know, over the course of the month of June. And there were dozens of events. There were so many, like not just the last week, the march, opening closing ceremony, Youth Pride, Pride Fest, the rally that we did in front of Stonewall, there were 7,000 or 8,000 people there, phenomenal. There were events all month. There was a mural project that we did for World Pride where murals that were queer themed and celebrating the queer community and honoring Stonewall veterans and honoring the history of Stonewall. in every borough of New York City. Like, this was not just a, you know, Greenwich Village party. This was the entire city and really the country and really the world embraced it. I mean, no one is ever going to do World Pride the way New York does, you know? And so it was absolutely, I mean, I don't really, I am often, you know, I'm not often at a loss for words, but it really was an extraordinary once-in-a-lifetime experience. And being able to be sort of in the middle of it and behind the scenes was something that, you know, I mean, it just, it was really amazing. And there are, you know, the theme for Pride this year in New York was a million moments of Pride. And, you know, I was kind of joking with the staff the other day when I was in the office that, you know, I could probably come up with more than a million. Like, I could individual moments that I experienced, some of which had, you know, they were applicable to the work that I was doing, but a lot of them were not. Some of them were just like, I remember being at Youth Pride and just, you know, looking out at this crowd. They had 10,000 young people show up. Last year they had 5,000. It was done in Central Park and Summer Stage to see this incredibly diverse group of young people. Gave me so much hope for the future because they're the ones that are going to be carrying the ball for our community into the next 50 years. And what I see in them is a lot less baggage than my generation had. And so, you know, there is the sort of nitty-gritty things we could talk about the events and about the media covering all those things. But for me, it was really the big picture. It was a gathering of a global queer community that I think really gets that we're in this together and that, you know, we may not agree on everything. We may, in fact, vehemently disagree on some things. But we have to keep our eye on the ball and try to remember who the real enemies are and stay away from divisiveness and try and, within our community, build bridges to help the world better understand who we are and why we need to be treated with equality and respect. And coming out of this month of June, after several days of sleeping a lot because we were all exhausted, it was really, I have this incredible sense of peace and accomplishment. It's a really lovely combination. And it is unlike really anything. I mean, Brody, you know, and you know I've dealt with sort of huge issues, whether it's marriage equality or don't ask, don't tell, and of course everything around mass murder. This felt different. It felt different for a lot of reasons, but I think it was because we just brought so many different people together from all over the world. Time when, especially here in the U.S., I think people really needed a sign of community and hope and coming together in both celebration and anger. I don't know if that makes sense, but like it really was that. And it can be those things. Those things can, you know, coexist easily. If you were at the march on Sunday, June 30th, you saw that. I mean, you saw people who were there to just, you know, to have fun, to have a day where they could just be themselves. And then, you know, for others, me included, event. And, you know, as I kept saying to the press at the end of the day, 5 million of us in one city, as visible as we are, is pretty political in and of itself. I mean, there's just no getting around it. It was really an amazing statement.
I am completely floored just hearing you describe all this, Kathy. It's like, I obviously was very aware of everything, but with the way you just described the whole event, I'm seriously jaw-dropped, floored. I am dearly hoping at this point that somebody was documenting, that there's like a documentary film that is going to come out, you know, demonstrating everything you just described, because that is phenomenal. And, yeah, it's like I'm completely amazed. That was astounding
and
beautiful.
The media coverage was amazing, and there were several documentaries that were done, sort of in process. But I one of the lights for me in terms of the media, I don't know how much of this you saw. The New York Times did an amazing job covering everything. I mean, we met with them in January to start planning. I mean, folks were really the media, with some exceptions, was extremely hyped to really take advantage of this. This is a year, I mean, 1969 was a big year historically here in the U.S. You had the moon landing, you had Woodstock, you had all these other things. And the fact that the Stonewall anniversary was included in that just as part of American history, to me, was very significant. I knew when we started getting, you know, our calls returned in December and January to say, let's sit down and meet out. And the New York Times, you know, they had a dozen staff in a room and five people on the phone, and we went to meet with them. And they said, we want to do this and this and this and this, and we'd like to do a special pullout section that just commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. Like, that kind of stuff, that's once-in-a-lifetime kind of stuff. You know, and
right.
they did an incredible job. And, you know, yes, there was a really great story about the mural project, but part of why they brought me in and part of the goal of the folks at New York City Pride was to make sure the coverage was really good. And so we provided a ton of resources and names and suggestions for other coverage that had nothing to do with New York City Pride, but had everything to do with making sure that the coverage was diverse, that it was fair, that it was accurate, that it was historically accurate. Like you said, Mark Siegel was, I mean, he was running all over the place. I mean, there are not that many legitimate Stonewall veterans left. And we worked extremely hard, you know, with the gay folks. We worked with historians like Eric Marcus and Carter to really make sure the media could get it right, because it's really easy to get it wrong sometimes.
Well, I think
and
that's
Kathy,
important.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Actually, go ahead, Rob.
Sorry, Brett. Yeah. You tweeted out, retweeted actually, an article from, I think it was the New York Times, said that was called "Who Threw the First Brick at Stonewall."
Oh yeah.
What as you were telling our story accurately, what part of history did you want to make sure was clear?
I think for so many people, and David Carter talks about this a lot, his book about the Stonewall Uprising is really sort of the definitive historical account of what, to the best of our knowledge, we know happened then, those six nights in 1969. But, you know, the fact is there's this sort of like this legend quality to it. There's the, you know, I hate to even repeat these things, there's the Marsha P. Johnson threw the first shot glass. Like, I mean, there was a lot of sort of myth and mythology and inaccuracy that gets thrown around. And what was really important for us was to find authentic voices, you know, that we people we knew were participants, historians that we knew had accurate information, and then to put it into context. And that video that you referenced that Shane O'Neill did was amazing because it did it in a way that was respectful, that was genuine, it was authentic, it included diverse voices, as many diverse voices as he could find, because the sad reality is that of the Stonewall veterans that do remain, we've lost so many, and we have lost, sadly, many who were part of more diverse communities, particularly trans women and trans women of color. So it was very important for Shane to sort of tell that story and, you know, demystify some of the sort of mythology around Stonewall, you know, to really talk about what the bar was like. I mean, I would get calls from journalists and, you know, usually they're a bit on the younger side, not to be ageist, but, you know, they would say things like, yes, the Stonewall, it was a safe space, you know, and try not to laugh. And I'd be like, okay, I was only four when this happened, but I've read a history book, you know, it was a dump. It was scary. It got raided all the time. It was run by the mafia and the cops, you know, beat people up on a regular basis. It was not really a safe space, but you could go and have
no.
a drink and you could dance, you know, that was, which in 1969 was a big deal. So just trying to sort of, you know, reframe the history of the reality of what life was like then was really, really important. And that's where people like folks like Mark and others from the Gay Liberation Front and other Stonewall vets that we knew were extremely helpful in trying to really help people understand what it was like to be gay in 1969 and who was there. Because the reality is when the police raided the bar. You know, it was just another raid. What sparked it that night, as best we understand, was that one butch lesbian in particular, and then several others who were also there, finally said, you know what, we're not going to take it anymore. And the folks who ran away almost immediately were the sort of more, I would say, straight acting, because most of them were, you know, gay men who were, they were either married, they were afraid for their jobs. It was the folks who had nothing to lose that stayed and fought, especially initially.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then there were the folks that ended up becoming the Gay Liberation Front that started, you know, chalking on the walls and on the sidewalks, come back to the Stonewall, you know, and so they kept the protest and the it wasn't really a riot per se, but the protest and the uprising going for those, you know, 6 nights that it happened. And so it was really important to help people understand that and at the same time not take away from the extraordinary contributions of people like Marsha P. Johnson, who we have on audio saying, I wasn't there at the beginning of it, I got there a little later. Doesn't take away from the fact that she was a voice for the voiceless. She saved lives. She was an advocate for the trans community when there wasn't even the word transgender, you know? And so...
And Kathy, I have to interrupt because we are literally out of time. This has been fascinating, wonderful, and you absolutely have to come back. You know, I'm not even going to invite you. I'm going to demand it. Being blunt. So I want to thank you so much for all your work and everything. Yeah, everything you've done and continue to do. Brody, thank you so much. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. The theme tonight with Kathy is, you know, voice for the voiceless, because I think that's incorporates your work as well, which kudos and admiration and deep gratitude for everything you have done. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, as always. Again, please find us on the podcast button on your smartphones. You can listen to us anytime and subscribe to Rated LGBT Radio. You know, we will be back here again next week with another fascinating program, I promise you. Also, listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time. We will have a fascinating show for you there, a little bit more about culture and what's happening in the Santa Cruz area specifically. But for Brody and myself, I want to thank you very, very much again for tuning in. And again, Kathy, I'm completely floored. Beautiful show, beautiful. Everything you've said is just absolutely astounding, as are you. And so with that, I bid you all good night.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.